Committee on Energy will now come to order. For the record, it is 10:21 a.m. and it is March 26, 2015, and let's have roll call. Madam Clerk, can you do the roll call?
Here. Present.
Here.
Representative
Tara?
Here.
Representative
Colton? Here. Co-chair Vasquez. Thank you. Here. Today we will have an overview presentation on the Susitna-Watanana Hydroelectric Project and the Renewable Energy Fund. Ms. Sarah Fisher-Goad, Executive Director of the Alaska Energy Authority, will be presenting. Also, Sean Scaling, Director of Programs and Evaluation. Welcome. And for the record, please state your name and your titles.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Sarah Fisher-Goad, Executive Director of the Alaska Energy Authority.
And Sean Scaling, Director of Programs and Evaluation at Alaska Energy Authority.
It's not on the screen, are we?
It's just
okay. Okay.
You may proceed, and as you discuss each slide, please make reference to the slide number.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and we're having a little technical.
My apologies.
Okay. What we're going to do today is first talk a little bit about the Renewable Energy Fund and then move in towards the Susitna-Watanana project. And when we come to that point, I do have a couple of folks on the line to help with the presentation, Betsy McGregor, Environmental Manager for the project, and Brian Carey, Engineering Manager, to answer some questions. Betsy's actually going to help with some of the presentation as we move forward. Just real quickly, we usually like to start our presentations out just to kind of give an overview of the Alaska Energy Authority. We manage statewide programs. Our mission is to reduce the cost of energy in Alaska. We have the ability to own and operate some projects. We cannot own new projects. However, we did get the authority to own and develop the Susitna-Watanana project in 2011. However, a lot of our programs to carry out the reducing the cost of energy really fall in under the statewide programs under AS 4245. And the Renewable Energy Program is one of those programs that falls in under that statute for energy programs for Alaska. We've really taken an effort to try and focus on communities. We really want to take a community-based approach to projects, a holistic approach that combines not just about renewable energy projects, but also some of our core infrastructure projects that we've constructed for, in particular, rural Alaska for like the last 14 to 15 years. So we're really looking at trying to make sure that we can help communities move into project ready status by making sure that their basic energy infrastructure can take on the integration of a renewable project. And internally, we've tried to work on breaking down any internal silos, that it's not about rural energy versus alternative energy. It's really about community development, the planning, the program development, project evaluation, and then the actual implementation of those projects. I'm going to have Sean Scaling now start talking about more specifics of the Renewable Energy Grant Fund and providing that overview. And
okay. For the record, we are now on slide number 4. Is that correct?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, thank
Madam
you.
Chair. And Madam Chair, I did want to, you know, it's always a pleasure to have an opportunity to come to House Energy to present the programs, the evolution of the programs, and kind of the advancements that we've made on them. So I really appreciate the invitation to talk not only about the Renewable Energy Fund, but the Susitna-Watanana project.
Thank you. So continuing on slide 4, I could actually spend a lot of time on this, but I actually did present a very quick overview by phone in early February. So what I'm going to try to do is augment, and we have more time to get into a little bit more detail. So I'm going to try to focus on some of the areas I wasn't able to focus on the first time. On this slide, the first two slides are just kind of overview of the benefits of the Renewable Energy Fund program, and focusing on bullet number two, helping achieve the state's renewable goal of 50% by 2025. We do measure this goal. We also have to rely on some EIA data that comes in a little bit late. So the most recent numbers we have is 2012, but we're at about 24%, and we know that there's been some significant growth in wind since then, and there's some hydro coming on soon later. So I'll get into more of the statistics later, but it's just exciting to see the progress toward that goal through this program. And also, it's pretty notable that in certain regions of the state, we are seeing great progress toward that goal. Kodiak Island, for example, is in the high 90s. Kodiak community itself is 99% renewable energy on the electric side. There are some others. Southeast, for example, is at about 97% renewable. Of course, not all communities are unrenewable, and so there's a difference there. But so there are quite a few regions of the state that are hitting some high marks on the percentage of renewable. On the next bullet down, displaces volatile fuel, volatile-priced fuels. That really is one of the main, you know, positive outcomes of the project. It's reducing at this point about 15 million gallons of fuel a year. And if you can just picture how much a million gallons is, you know, in picture a 1,000-gallon tank and 15,000 of them. It's a lot of fuel every year, and that's increasing. And I have some more statistics to show that later on. So there are just so many benefits to it. The next one I wanted to focus on is just expanding the renewable energy knowledge base. It is pretty incredible how much more knowledge there is in the state about how to integrate renewables successfully into the electric grids and how to use renewables for heat. We've really come leaps and bounds since this program started, thanks to this program and to the vision of the legislature in 2008 to establish the program. There are many other benefits, and I'll skip the rest. You can read those.
Mr. Scaling, before you proceed, I do have several questions with regard to the slide, but before I proceed to my questions, I want for the record to state that Representative Tilton has joined us. Thank you. With regard to state renewable goal of 50% by 2025, when was that established for the record?
In 2008, I believe. It was in 2010, based on 2010. Did I get that right?
Madam Chair, it was actually the those goals were established by a House Energy Bill at the time, and it was in 2010.
Do you recall which House bill that was?
It would have been House Bill 306 in that session.
And how is renewable defined for this purpose, for this goal?
Renewable is defined in statute. For this program, it includes wind, hydro, biomass, woody biomass, geothermal, solar, kind of all the typical renewables that you'd expect. And it also has an option for other local fuels, for example, local natural gas, for example, if that was ever available in a community that didn't have other alternatives.
Thank you. And of course, this definition is different from the federal definition set forth by the Environmental Protection Agency. Is that correct? Renewable energy is defined, excludes hydro?
Madam Chair, I think there's a, if you look at the EPA website and if you look at the Department of Energy website, they do define renewable, it can include hydroelectric power, but what we've actually been working on is trying to better define what programs hydroelectric power is available for. And for example, there are financing options that hydroelectric power is available for, but when energy statistics are put together with respect to the renewable power used for or defining how much renewable power is used, oftentimes they don't include hydroelectric power. So we're trying to kind of refine that a little bit to really kind of dig down into the federal programs on defining hydro or defining renewable.
So in a nutshell, for the federal programs, renewable will exclude hydro. but for financing and for state purposes, it includes hydro.
Yes, Madam Chair, and it does kind of vary. It can be complicated. I wish there was a black and white answer with respect to that, but it just depends on the type of program. And it's actually a good, you know, for example, there's a lot of projects that we think are very good, valuable projects for communities. They may not fit nicely into the Renewable Energy Grant Fund program. They may be the best project for the community, but it may not fit the statutory requirements of the program. And I think on the federal level, there's a few things like that that I think there are programs that we think that hydro probably should be considered as a renewable resource, but they may not be. But again, for certain financing programs and for certain definitions, they do have hydro listed as a renewable resource, but we think it should be, you know, more.
Thank you. You may proceed.
Thank you. And I guess one more comment along that line of reasoning. The U.S. Energy Agency has a strong hydro goal called Hydro Vision. Excuse me, and they're looking at unleashing as much hydro as possible in the form of energizing water systems that aren't currently energized, say for irrigation and whatnot. So there is a fairly strong federal push, but it ends up being kind of department by department and grant program by funding program. So the Renewable Energy Fund has some other benefits. This first one listed there is the
value. Mr. Scaling, yes, and sir. This is slide number 5, thank correct?
You. Yes, slide 5, thank you. So it has a very strong economic and technical evaluation process. The benefit to that is that all of these renewable projects coming through the state can kind of go through the same vetting process and be compared against each other so that the public money can go to the best use possible. So we pride ourselves in the evaluation process. There is an emphasis in statute toward high-cost areas and providing a regional balance. And I listed there the applicant types and the eligible projects. Along the eligible projects, getting back to your question, Ms. Chair, I failed to mention transmission of renewables is also an option that can be funded through the Renewable Energy Fund if you're connecting a renewable source to a community that doesn't have the renewables. And just one more thing on that slide I was going to mention. The projects are funded in phases, and so we'll often first see if an application for a feasibility study for a project. If feasibility proves out, then the applicant will come back for funding for design and or construction. And so we try to carefully balance between maximizing the use of the public funds and the speed of the projects, because it does take time to get through those processes, but it also maximizes the benefit of the public funds to produce as much renewable power as possible with those dollars. I'm only going to focus on the first two bullets here because I have a slide later on that answers the rest. We're on slide 6 now. The Renewable Energy Fund program recently got an award from the Clean Energy States Alliance in combination with Kodiak Electric. It was recognizing both the program and Kodiak's excellence in combining hydro and wind and battery to produce, I think last year they ended with 99.6% renewable electricity in Kodiak. So that's absolutely the poster child for Alaska's renewables. And I mentioned the 15 million gallons saved. Next slide.
And making reference, Mr. Scaling, to slide 6. Is that correct?
Yes, that was on slide 6. And next slide is now slide 7. This is just a funding summary showing rounds 1 through 7. The rounds is equivalent to a year. Every year we put out a request for applications in July. The applications are typically due in September. They go through the evaluation process to prepare for the legislature. So that shows 732 applications after round 8, which is what the legislature is currently looking at as far as our recommendation goes. The applications received is now about 800. You can see the applications funded. One important distinction here is an application, as I said, does not equate to a project, because some projects have multiple applications or multiple funding. So it's about 185 distinct projects. and we have currently about 125 active grants. So a lot of activity. This map actually shows, this is slide 8, shows the activity level. These are all the grants that have been funded, rounds 1 through 7. You can see the regional distribution is strongly in place here. There are dots all over the map. Every one of those dots, of course, will represent a community because a stranded renewable lacks value because you have to get it to the community. So this is a lot of communities that are touched by the Renewable Energy Fund. And next slide. This shows the dollars spent by resource. So you can see wind and hydro are each roughly 35% of the fund, and then biomass, heat recovery, and heat pumps, all heat type projects are next. One thing that the fund has done nicely is it allows enough flexibility that we can change with the times in that originally there were a lot of electric applications, but we heard a lot of feedback that heat is very, very important. And so several rounds ago in the request for application, we emphasized that we were encouraging heat applications, and we've gotten quite a few. And while those don't have a lot of dollars, there are a lot of projects in the heat area. Typically, the heat projects are on a building level or on a multi-building level as opposed to a whole community or community grid level like the electric projects are.
Mr. Scaling, you've been referring to slide number 9. Is that correct?
Yes.
Thank you.
I will remember that at some point. Thank you,
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We've had other presentations this year where they mentioned different types of renewable resources, including river turbine generation. Is how much anything being done with tidal in Alaska?
Through the chair, Representative Wold, yes, particularly
ocean tide. I meant
ocean tidal. Well, we've done some resource studies, and there are some. At this point, not very much, and that would typically not be through the Renewable Energy Fund anymore, but through the Emerging Energy Technology Fund. That was another nice partnership of these two programs working really well together so that Renewable Energy Fund can really focus on the projects that can that we know are going to make economic sense, and the emerging is to bolster those. For example, False Pass has been very thoroughly studied, the water, the tidal resource passing through there. It seems to be a strong tidal resource. The issue then is providing cost-effective device deployment in those waters to then serve what's really a very small community and a very small load. So at that point, it's just a matter of doing it cost-effectively.
Okay, thank you.
And if I can add, Madam Chair, Representative Woolley, this, as Sean mentioned, the connection between the Emerging Energy Technology Fund and the Renewable Energy Fund, that the False Pass project, it doesn't fit the greatest into the Renewable Energy Fund because of the issues that were mentioned, but it is actually a very good location to do some additional testing for hydrokinetic through the Emerging Energy Technology Fund. So there is it's again a good project, but it just doesn't quite fit into those metrics that statutorily we're required to look at.
Mm-hmm. Excuse me. Representative Clayman.
You made reference to heat project. Is that what is listed in the chart as heat recovery?
Through the chair, Representative, the heat projects include biomass. Heat recovery is included as a heat project, and that's typically taking the excess heat from a small community diesel power system and using that heat in a nearby building. So that is a heat type as well. And then heat pumps and geothermal. Heat pumps are generally heat. Geothermal is generally electric, but you can also have a direct use of heat from geothermal as well.
So follow through the chair.
You may.
He's actually referencing several different things on this chart.
Yes, that's true.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
And through the chair, one addition to that is sometimes excess hydro and excess wind can go to heat too, but their primary purpose and the most economic use of those resources is electric. But sometimes excess energy from those systems will go to heat as well. I'm now on slide 10. This again just shows the regional distribution of the funds to date through round 7. slide 11, I earlier referenced that I had a better graphic for some of the information. This is it. So this is showing the net present value of the money that's gone into, the capital money that's gone into these projects. When I say these projects, this is the first 44 projects in operation. They've received about $100 million from the Renewable Energy Fund. They've garnered about $200 million of other funding. And the net present value lifetime benefits for those projects is nearly $900 million. So the benefit-cost ratio of the program as a whole is about 2.8, which is a great number. And, of course, if you look at just the cost to the Renewable Energy Fund, it's much better than that even. And next slide, which would be number 12.
Mrs. Gilling, before you proceed.
Yes.
When did the program start?
The program started in 2008. I have a slide coming up here shortly. It was interesting to see in those early years as we got through feasibility and design and construction and then finally to operation. It was a bit of a slow start, but we are at full speed now. So I've got a nice slide to show that.
Sure.
Oh, and here is the slide I was just talking about. This is slide 12. This shows the fuel displaced by the Renewable Energy Fund projects that are in operation by year, starting in 2009. You can see there was probably some patience needed on the part of the legislature in those early few years as we got projects all the way through to construction. A huge leap in 2013. You can see 2014 just ended. That is our annualized number, meaning it's the first three quarters of the year with our guess at how the year ended. We'll have an update to that very shortly, which will be published as typical in a couple of weeks on the AEA website. And then we've projected out future years. This year, I did look at how past years, how our projections have been compared to actual, and they've generally been, the projections have been just low of actual. So we've actually had a great track record anticipating what's coming in future years. So there's another big jump in 2015 with a lot of projects, a lot of small projects coming through to completion, and several hydro projects. You can see the hydro wedge there grows quite a bit. Have just started at the last part of last year and the first parts of this year, including Whitman Lake, Blue Lake, Gartina Falls, we expect will be coming online this year in Hoonah, and many, many others. So on to slide 13.
Representative Clayman.
Looking, comparing on slide 11 and slide 12, I'm seeing in terms of both the capital cost and in terms of the benefits, substantially more on wind power than anything else. And then I flip to slide 12, and it looks like the wind power is kind of continuing on the same path, but you're showing a fairly substantial projected increase in hydropower, which hasn't been part of the history. And to some extent, I guess you just answered, but I'm curious why wind power has been so accessible and hydropower really hasn't done very well, at least up till now.
Through the chair, Representative Clayman, it's a good point. I probably should have pointed out wind can be developed relatively quickly, whereas hydro does take much longer to get through permitting and design and construction. Every one of those phases takes longer. And so it's essentially been a speed of development process. But as you're seeing now, many more of those hydro projects are just coming through construction.
And Madam Chair, if I might add too, one of the things that we saw, you know, this program was established in 2008. However, prior to that, we had Alaska Energy Authority had some federal grants for wind development. And through the Denali Commission and through the U.S. Department of Energy, we were able to do a lot of upfront work on met tower establishments and doing some of the feasibility analysis that when this program came to be, there are a lot of somewhat shovel-ready shovel-ready wind projects that were really ready to move to the next step and really primed to be ready to receive renewable energy funds. So that's in some respects why we had a bit of a leap with the wind projects from the get-go.
Thank you.
And following through the chair, I'm seeing on slide 8 a lot of wind projects kind of in western Alaska in the Aleutian chain. Sounds like a windy place, but also a fairly affordable place to get wind power installed, whereas, as you described, the hydro projects are much more expensive to construct and have a lot more permitting issues and other issues that come along with them.
Through the chair, Representative, the map does depict where the resources exist strongly. So you're correct. The West Coast Solutions does have a lot of wind. It's also relatively flat terrain, which isn't ideal for, well, at least the YK Delta, not necessarily ideal for hydro. Whereas southeast, you can see lots of, and even south central, lots of blue dots. There's a good rain resource and good topography.
Thank you.
Representative Culver.
Yeah, on slide 12, you have a one at the top of the bar chart, wind to heat. Can you explain how that works?
Certainly. Through the chair, Representative Culver, wind to heat is times when the wind is producing more energy than the community can use, and you have to use electricity immediately. You produce it, you use it, and if you ever exceed, you've got to do something with that extra heat, either just put it off in the atmosphere or use it. And so this is just recognizing the use of that excess heat to heat buildings. Oftentimes it's an electric boiler in a large building, say in the school or in the wastewater plant. So it's offsetting diesel that would otherwise be used to produce that heat by first heating it with the excess electricity.
Thank you.
Representative Will.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What is the hydro projects that are coming on this year, it looks like, projected?
Whitman and Blue Lake, through the chair, mm-hmm. I believe are the biggest contributors to that. Gartina Falls in Hoonah is also expected to come online, and so I think we've gathered, you know, half a year's of production from that project in the anticipated graph. I can't remember if there are others.
And with regard to each, for the record, how many megawatts?
Oh, there are so many numbers. I don't remember them all. Gartina Falls is the small one. It produces about a third of Hoonah's load. And I could follow up with you after if you'd like.
450 kW.
Oh, thank you, Jody. 450 kW. Blue Lake expansion, I don't have the numbers off the top of my head. I could reference them quickly. But that's an expansion of an existing to provide a lot more benefit using the existing, building upon the building existing infrastructure.
Thank you. Any other questions, follow-up questions? You may proceed.
Thank you. This is slide 13. This is just depicting by region the number of dollars and the count, which is hasn't been represented before, of projects in each region. And you can see the number of dollars doesn't necessarily recognize the number of projects. In particular, if you look at Kodiak and Yukon-Koyukuk Upper Tanana, they're right beside each other as far as dollars, but one has 7 projects, the other one has 31. Again, recognizing some larger, more expensive projects versus a lot of small, generally heat projects. Slide 14. Now we're getting into the round 8 recommendations. These are the recommendations that we put forward to the legislature early in this session. After going through, it's a 4-stage evaluation process. The first stage is eligibility, and then the rubber really hits the road with stage 2, which is technical and economic evaluation, which essentially gets us to a yes-no point for every project that's submitted. After that, it's a matter of ranking according to the statutory criteria, and then regional distribution. So what we've put is 40 projects. I'm sorry, 40 projects within the governor's $15 million budget. There are 34 projects, 5 of which have a cap of $1.5 million, and there are 18 heat projects and 16 standard projects. As far as the regional distribution goes, we spent a little bit more time on that with the Renewable Energy Fund Advisory Committee this year to ensure that we had good regional representation. We changed the formula a bit on how we determine that and ended up with a couple of regions that were considered underserved, a couple that were considered overserved. And so with Southeast in particular, that last bullet is indicating that in that overserved area of Southeast, The funding was limited to 22.15%, which is the percentage that they already had of the fund. So basically allowing Southeast to continue to have a lot of projects, but limiting its growth so it doesn't take on more. The most interesting factor, I believe, in that was the way that we calculated it was based on household energy cost burden, that being what is the average home in the area pay for heat and electricity divided by average income. And that was kind of the basis of the decision on regional distribution, which was a recommendation from the advisory committee.
Okay. And for the record, you're making reference to slide number 14?
Yes, thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Tallarico.
Thank you very much. You'd mentioned that the projects have funding caps. How many of those projects then are short of their full funding?
There are five.
Five that won't be fully funded because of the cap?
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
What is the five projects?
We've been in touch with those projects to try to determine, you know, what is the impact and what do they intend to do with, and it really kind of depends on the expensive project for which they applied for $4 million. We originally recommended $4 million before the cap was applied, but it's a $24 million project, so they need to go for financing one way or the other. There's another project that was requesting, I think it was 90% of the construction funding for St. Mary's Pitcus Point Wind, and I guess it's a little unclear where that one will go, financing or a delay to wait for another year or what exactly.
And what type of financing do they usually pursue?
AEA has a power project loan fund that is available for some of these projects. Not all are eligible. Other than that, there is RUS funding available that many projects tap into. Sarah, do you have any more to contribute?
Madam Chair, this was something that when we were looking at a $15 million budget request and trying to provide a regional balance, there were a couple projects that did have a significant cost associated with them that in prior years we were able to, you know, fully recommend and the legislature funded at the full recommendation. So this hasn't been an easy round as we look at this. And so I think one of the things that we'll see with the evolution of the project is looking at or evolution of the program is when a project becomes ready for construction, what other financing is available. And so this is the first year that we're doing this, so we are looking at what these other options. I think Mr. Scaling has outlined what's available with AEA. We are more than willing to work with any of the applicants with respect to other funding sources. In addition, that one of the things that we want to talk to our advisory committee about after session is, you know, looking ahead on this, where we want to, you know, exercise some patience with respect to are these projects that we recommend for funding allow them to wait one more year before they move forward with the project to see if they would then be eligible for perhaps round nine. And so we're trying to figure out how to kind of balance those issues. And I know, you know, there are some projects that we think are probably can be ready for loans, that they can still be very good projects for the communities. But as Mr. Scaling mentioned, I think the St. Mary's project is one that's a little bit, could be a bit challenged with that type of a cap.
I have a follow-up question. So we're not sure, at least your agency is not sure how to deal with those projects that are not fully funded at this point in time.
Madam Chair, what we've been doing and what Mr. Scaling has done is reached out to each of those projects that has been capped. Now, there are some projects that we've capped on the recommendation level where perhaps they've asked for some funds beyond what they need for, or they may be looking for additional milestones to be funded, and so we've capped them for particular milestones at this. But there are these five projects, so Mr. Scaling has reached out to those applicants to kind of work with them to see what they plan on doing on that, and so we are working with them. It is a little bit of a, you know, a bit of uncharted territory, but not not unexpected with respect to what we I think we're going to be seeing with this fund in the future.
What loan available within your agency?
The Madam Chair, the Power Project Fund is probably the most logical program for many of these projects. Now, any project that has a funding, a state participation of greater than $5 million, whether it's a combination of grant or loan, would need legislative approval. And that can be done through an appropriation process that, you know, where the fund is specifically appropriated to the Power Project Fund for that project. So that meets the statutory requirement of legislative approval, and it also provides funds for that specific project. There is also the ability to have just an authorization without an appropriation. We are getting to the point, though, where we're a little concerned about the balance of the fund with respect to what would be needed in the fund for certain projects. So, you know, for example, we actually had last year an authorization for the city of Sitka to help finance the rest of the Blue Lake expansion project. They ended up not using the Power Project Fund as their source. They ended up using the Municipal Bond Bank, which was able to provide them a better rate at that point than we could provide through the Power Project Fund. So the PPF, though, has been very well used. It's a program that I think has provided a tremendous amount of value to borrowers, large and small, with respect to the programs. So we anticipate using that even more.
So in summary, if the combination of state funding, whether it be loan and grants, exceeds $5 billion, you need to go before the legislature?
Yeah, per project. If the project. So you could have $1 million loan and a $5 million grant, you would still need legislative approval for that loan.
Okay. Is there any other loan ministers?
Madam Chair, no, not for these types of projects.
Representative Culver.
Yeah, could you briefly describe what are the top-rated projects in this current round?
Through the chair, Representative Culver, the types of project by energy resource type,
or just the top, maybe the top five, what they are, how mm-hmm. much, what kind of a project they are.
Certainly, and I'm referencing now the Renewable Energy Fund status report that all legislators received at the beginning of session. The top one is Angoon low-income housing pellet.
Okay, Mr. Scaling, for the record, can you please state the page number you're referring to?
So this is the Renewable Energy Fund status report and round 7 recommendations. It can be found on the AEA website right on the front page. And this is pages 10 and 11 have a large spreadsheet that have a lot of kind of top-level statistics about every project that's recommended this year. So I guess let me do it a little bit more in summary.
Mr. Scalings, what I'd like to do is call a short brief at ease, get copies of that made and distributed to the committee members, or I guess we can proceed with the hearing and simply have copies made and we'll go back and have everyone with the spreadsheet.
Certainly, Madam Chair.
That would be useful. So can you hand that over to my aide and he can make copies?
Certainly, and I believe you have a few and probably just need a couple extras.
Okay.
And in fact, I have one more, which I think would mean that you would only need one additional.
We can share.
We can share those in the committee, yeah, but we need to have enough for the audience. We'll call a short at ease. Question for the record, it is about 11:09. Mr. Scaling, you may proceed. Now we have the spreadsheet in front of us.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. So I was answering a question of Representative Culver. And that question was, what are some examples of the top projects recommended? So in the top five, there are three that are biomass projects. And again, this is in the document that you now all have, pages 10 and 11. And then the next two, one's a heat recovery project, and one is a heat-to-wind project, using excess wind to produce heat, as we had talked about earlier. There is a column right in the middle of the page that's energy source. That'll show you what types of projects they are. Toward the right side, there's recommended phase that'll tell you if it's a design project or construction or feasibility. The dollar amounts are in there, and then the cumulative funding. This is backed up. If additional information is wanted on any of these projects, our website has all the information, including our reviews, the economic evaluation that was conducted, and the actual application itself.
Thank you, Mr. Scaling. Now we'll proceed to slide 15. Is that correct?
Yes. Slide 15, this is just emphasizing a point on the prior slide, which was there are a lot of different temperature zones in Alaska. This is one way to look at it in terms of heating degree days, and again, in recognition of the fact that some areas of the state use a lot more energy than others.
Thank you.
Slide 16. Again, we're in the section about the recommended projects for this year, so these are the recommended heat projects. And you can see the distribution around the state. And the next slide, 17, shows the recommended, we call them standard projects. They're generally electric projects, but this can also include transmission.
And for the record, this is all for this year?
Yes, this is round eight, the ones that are recommended to the legislature for funding right now.
And Madam Chair, if I can add to one of the reasons that we've kind of bifurcated the application process is that the Renewable Energy Fund Advisory Committee asked us in particular to make sure that we emphasize heat projects. And so we thought the best way to do that is to actually have these two separate application processes instead of having a one-size-fits-all application process. After 5 years of the program, we also had done an evaluation of the program, and this was one of the recommendations that came out also, was to, instead of having a one-size-fits-all application process, is to really kind of to split it out a little bit differently to kind of make that emphasis. So that's why we do kind of have these two lists or two processes that we go through.
Thank you. The next slide.
I'm now on slide 18. Slides 18 and 19 are both showing one point, and that is that $15 million gallons of fuel saved this year, who benefits from it? And the benefits really range. In particular, commercial businesses in rural Alaska benefit because they're not eligible for PCE. Community buildings save fuel. Residential over the PCE allotment is a savings. Schools save, and the PCE program itself. And the next slide, which is slide 19, is just a little bit simpler graphic showing the community savings of the program so far based on the first projects in construction.
You're making reference to slide number 18, is that correct?
19 now.
19, thank you.
Slide number 20. I thought it might be helpful just to delve a little bit into a couple of the resource types, just to have a better understanding. Each of the resource types has a lot of ins and outs, and I should mention that I'm really proud of the AEA staff. We have some really top-notch experts who are doing the evaluations and managing these projects, and they've gone through this learning process over this last 8 years. But in the hydroelectric program, for example, or hydroelectric projects, there are a couple of different types. The main types are, the main division is conventional or storage hydro, where you store some water for use when you want it. run of river, where you're essentially pulling some water out of a river, running it through a turbine and replacing it to the river. But you rely on what the river flows are, and so there are some seasons where you may not be producing much energy or so it relies on the seasonal flows. There are other types of hydroelectric, which are kind of a distinct category, but this gets to the hydrokinetic that we mentioned earlier and tidal, and there's even pumped storage, which doesn't take place in Alaska at this point, but it is a way of storing energy that's used in other parts of the world. The next slide is just different types of biomass.
Excuse me, for the record, which slide number?
Slide number 21. I'm sorry, Ms. Chair.
Thank you.
Slide 21, types of woody biomass. Biomass in general can be energy production from any type of a bio source. Alaska's is really focused on woody biomass. We've done a little bit of exploration into fish oil and some other pieces like that, but woody biomass is really where it's at as far as projects that work. So there are three major types: cordwood systems, which is, you know, cordwood that you stoke into a boiler, pictured in the top left picture. There are pellet boilers, where you you have small pellets that are extruded and manufactured that can be easily handled. And then there are chip boilers. It's basically just chipped wood, which is kind of between the two. And then there are some other types too, bricks and microchips and whatnot. But those are the three main types. On slide 22, the next slide, shows just a comparison of these biomass technologies. Just for example, cordwood, as I mentioned, is manual feed. One nice thing is it's part-time jobs in communities. And also, they're oftentimes part-time jobs for obtaining the wood. It's easy to operate, low fuel costs. Chips, on the other hand, also have a low fuel cost, but they're more complex to operate. But it is automatically fed, so you don't have to rely on somebody waking up early to stoke a boiler. Pellets are optimally easy. They're automatic feed, but the cost of the fuel is higher. So for every community, there's a right fit. And we've been working really hard with communities to understand these differences, to understand what they're getting into as they go into biomass.
Representative Colbert, you have a question?
No,
Representative Nykiak.
You have in there low fuel cost, and high fuel cost. What is the difference?
Through the chair, Representative Nykiak, the pellets have a manufacturing process they need to go through, and that's what adds the expense.
So it's higher.
Yeah, per BTU or per ton of wood that you get, it does cost more than, you know, per ton of wood of cordwood, for example. And oftentimes there's shipping, unless there's a pellet plant in your community, there's also a shipping cost to get it to your community.
All right, thank you.
Representative Colbert.
No, I'm good.
Okay. You may proceed.
So slide 23, I've just got a couple of success stories or stories to learn from both at the end of this presentation, this part of the presentation. So Thorn Bay Biomass is just a great success story. The school got a biomass boiler. It produced extra heat. They used that extra heat in a greenhouse. The students are now growing vegetables for their own school lunches, selling them within the community. So it's a new local food resource as well, which I don't think was originally envisioned when this went in, but it's a great benefit that's derived from it. So it's just spurring the local economy in many different ways. And it's also part of the school curriculum. And the next slide, 24, mm-hmm. is just some statistics about Kodiak. They had some existing hydro from Terror Lake, built in the 80s, added three wind turbines and then three more for a total of 9 megawatts of installed capacity of wind. And the wind and hydro work really well. So when the wind is blowing, they have storage hydro. They can store more water for use later. And so it's been a really nice combination. In addition, they added a battery bank because if the wind suddenly drops off, it takes 30 to 90 seconds to get the hydro ramped up to fill that void, and so they have a battery bank that fills that void. So it's just a great example. I mean, nearly 100%. I understand that last little bit is just to keep their diesels tuned up and ready to go. They also got a third turbine for their hydro plant, so now they, when they shut down for maintenance on the hydro, they are saving all the diesel that would be burned at that time. So great example good resources that are used well. Slide number 25, which is my last slide before we switch gears, it just shows the renewable energy impact in Kodiak. You can see on slide 25, the top line is without adding the winds to the existing system, and the green line is with. And so there's residents there would be paying 20 cents is estimated, as opposed to 15.8, which they're paying right now. So a nice benefit flowing through to the residents. I guess in summary, my take-home message for the Renewable Energy Fund is this program's got some great momentum. It's really, I think, achieving what the original founders that designed this program have set out providing benefits all across the state, reducing fuel. The learning that has gone on in the state in the last 8 years is just incredible. And for the sake of time, I will conclude my remarks there. Thank you, Ms. Chair.
Thank you. Any questions? We may proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, we do not have Wayne Dyack on the phone. However, I do have Betsy McGregor, our environmental manager, and Brian Carey, our engineering manager, to help answer some questions. And in a few slides in, Betsy will be talking a bit more about our environmental program on the Susitna-Watonna project. So one of the things to just to set the stage with respect to, you know, why hydro and where, you know, a little bit of history on the Susitna project. And my understanding is, on, you know, with this committee, with the start of a new legislature, with some new legislators, it was a good opportunity for us to, you know, take a step back and talk a little bit about the history of the project and what we learned and where we're at. So one thing, you know, Alaska has a very significant history of hydro, and as you can see, we're not done yet. There's still a lot of projects that are being built in Southeast Alaska and other parts of the state. One of the foundations of the Alaska Energy Authority, or one of the primary purposes of the authority, was to actually own and operate hydroelectric projects. The Four Dam Pool projects, which are the projects that serve Kodiak, Copper Valley, and Southeast Wrangell, Petersburg, and Ketchikan, which now they were originally owned and built by the Alaska Energy Authority or the Alaska Power Authority, now are owned by the individual utilities. But that was one of the starting points in the foundations of the hydro program. Bradley Lake Hydroelectric Project is, of course, produces some of the low-cost power in the rail belt, and a very significant project for the rail belt utilities and the ratepayers. So there's again a very good, strong foundation. We're sitting in a community that has over 100 years of hydro history and very low-cost power. So there's an ability to provide a long-term diversification. It's projects that actually provide some essentially inflation-proofing for a significant portion of your projects. So Bradley Lake, for example, 4.5 cents per kilowatt hour when it was built is still the cost per kilowatt hour that it's that it produces now with the long-term financing of that project. In a bit of a shout-out, we don't have anything against coal. It does rival coal for the temperatures, and Representative Tallarico, I know that coal and the ability for coal in interior Alaska helps keep power costs low in the interior. But it is clean and sustainable. It's reliable energy, and it does help with leveling out the cost of power, especially since a lot of fossil fuels do have a volatile price. So just some history with respect to the Susitna Hydro Project. It was really first studied in the 50s, and as many of you understand, in the 80s, the state did pursue the project, but for many different reasons, including oil prices being significantly low, and actually some at the time, long-term low natural gas contracts available really caused the project to be put on basically the back burner. And so the project was mothballed at the time. As energy prices rose in 2008 and 2009, there was an effort to really take a look at what the rail belt could use for a large hydro project. And so we were actually funded prior to receiving authorization for a specific project. We were funded to look at different possibilities in the rail belt. So we evaluated different projects and came up with a preliminary or primary decision document to show that really Susitna-Watonna, because of this history and all the work that we knew about the project in the 80s, was really the project to pursue for a large hydro project. And in 2011, we received the authorization and were funded to start moving forward with a FERC license. And really, the studies began on the Susitna River and the surrounding areas in 2012.
Ms. Fischer-Goad, you were making reference to slide number 27. Is that correct?
Yes, Madam Chair. And now we are on slide 28, just to give a little bit of some additional information about the project. That it, you know, the Rail Belt region is roughly 80% of the state's population, and it would provide roughly 50% of the Rail Belt's existing power. The project has a significant, you know, construction cycle and timelines, and would create approximately 1,000 jobs. As we've mentioned before, and just kind of the history of hydro, very much long-term diversification and having stable electric rates for 100 years. It does also support the renewable energy goal, and in fact, in order to really meet our 50% renewable goal, because of so much of the electricity in this in the Rail Belt region, you really do need a larger project in order to really meet the 50% goal. And it does maximize the value of Alaska's fossil fuels. And in addition, there's been a lot of talk about, you know, CO2 displacement and what would a large hydro project do. There's an annual CO2 displacement of 1.3 million tons that would come from a project of the Wautana project.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative from Clayman.
From the prior slide, a couple of questions. The first is that if you don't have this 50% renewal by 2025, do the economics of this project even come close to making any sense? I mean, back in the 3 or 4 years ago, we seemed to have a lot more money than we have today, but now we're talking about spending billions and billions of dollars on this dam. If you take out this renewable 50% goal, is how viable is this?
Well, through the chair, Representative Clayman, the renewable goal isn't part of the factor into the feasibility of the project. The renewable goal, I think, really set the stage for in an overall policy and programs that the legislature established in 2010. This was one of many things that the legislature was doing to move forward with it. So the 50% renewable goal is a goal, and we've found in actually many of the discussions, I think that goal has been very, very important to Alaskan residents to be able to pursue that goal. With respect to the financing of the project and moving forward with the licensing of the project, and first we will get into more detail with respect to some of the financing options, but we have not suggested that the project would be funded with general fund appropriations to AEA to build the project. We have early in the development of the project, and using Bradley Lake as an example, Bradley Lake received a capital contribution up front from the state of Alaska to build the project. It was roughly 50% of this capital contribution from the state, 50% of debt financing. However, in 2021, the utilities have this excess payment, which is roughly the same as a debt service amount to be paid back to the state of Alaska. So we use the Bradley model as kind of a financing model, but the structures and what we've asked our financial advising firm to look at for Susitna Wautana is assumed debt financing from the GIBCO, including the eventual payback of the state of Alaska for the original investment, including what we're currently funded for and expending for the licensing development.
A couple of follow-ups. How much does it cost to build Bradley Lake?
Through the chair, approximately $380 million was the cost to build Bradley Lake.
And so the difference between Bradley Lake, if you wanted to use in round numbers, maybe $400 million, the difference in order of magnitude of this dam is what? Like,
through the chair, over 10 times.
And what is the current estimate? I know there's a range of somewhere around $2 billion range about what they think this will cost. What's the current estimate of the cost to build this dam?
And in a few slides further down with our engineering work right now, we have an S-curve slide that shows that the most probable cost to build the project is roughly $5.6 to $5.7 billion. And again, including, that's not just construction costs. That includes the all-in pre-construction and the licensing costs.
Through the chair, we are looking at a dramatically larger. Have we built any other hydroelectric dam bigger than Bradley Lake to date? Or is Bradley Lake the biggest we've ever built in terms of cost?
Through the chair, Representative Clayman, this would be the largest project.
And the other question is, is Bradley Lake the largest we've built to date?
Through the chair, yes, I believe that's the largest hydro project in the state of Alaska.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Okay. Yes, a Representative Wood.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Rail Belt current production or proposed production capability in the next few years exceeds the state's consumption, or the Rail Belt's consumption, by quite a bit, we're told. So if we're going to produce another 50% more, and I don't know what the timeline is, what do we do with all that extra power?
Through the chair, Representative Lowell, this is something that we've worked quite closely with the utilities on with respect to the development of a precedent agreement and working with them on having the potential Susitna-Wetana project generation worked into the system. In fact, I think Chugach Electric Association has planned for a larger hydro project and also the ability or the that if this project is to become reality, that they'd be able to retire some of the old generation to have this project worked into their system. And this is something that in the 80s it's been a bit different that we've with the development of the project in the 80s versus what we're looking at now is that this project has been essentially right-sized to be 50% of the rail belt. The project in the 80s was looking at 1,600 megawatts and a three-phase, two-dam project rather than this one-dam project.
Okay. Any other questions, Mr. Wu? For the record, I have a few comments which may clear up your questions, Representative Wu.
Okay, thanks.
I'm going to ask a few questions so we can put a few facts on the record. How many megawatts does Bradley Lake produce?
Through the chair, I believe that capacity for Bradley Lake is 120 megawatts, and this is where I'm glad that Mr. Carey is on the phone. If Brian, if you could clarify that, please.
For the record, can he state his name and affiliation or title?
For the record, Brian Carey, Bradley Lake Project Manager. And the rated capacity that we use, that FERC and AEA uses for Bradley, is 120 megawatts.
Okay. And when was Bradley Lake constructed or finished?
To the chair, Bradley Lake came online in 1991. Okay. And that was following about a 4 or 5 year construction period.
And to how many utilities does Bradley Lake provide power to?
To the chair, the Bradley Lake provides power to a total of 6 utilities, which are all along the rail belt. So it provides power to the City of Seward, Homer Electric, Municipal Light and Power, Chugach Electric, Manisco Electric, and Golden Valley.
Okay. And is there operating agreement among the utilities to share this energy?
To the chair, there's many different agreements between the utilities and Alaska Energy Authority in regards to the payment for all the power and for how it's shared. Right now, the utilities all receive the energy and pay the bills on a basis of percentage shares, which was fixed up with the power sales agreement.
Okay. Thank you. Now going back to Ms. Fisher-Goad, and what is the projected megawatts for the Susitna-Wetana hydroelectric project?
The projected energy would be 2,800 gigawatt hours annually. The capacity or the megawatts is we've just finished the engineering feasibility report, and there is a slide that will cover this. So it's the capacity, I believe, is 459 based upon the generators and the turbines that would be installed into the system.
And what is the projected length of time for the construction of this dam?
Through the chair, I believe the projected length of time is about 7.5 years. And Brian, could you correct that or clarify that, please?
For the record, Brian Carey, engineering manager, Susitna-Wautauna project, and to the chair, the construction time period is approximately 7.5 to 8 years.
And that's assuming everything goes as planned, is that correct? Is that the best case scenario or the worst case scenario?
To the chair, it's the most probable, more on achievable scenario in terms of slightly aggressive, but the project could actually go faster or slower depending on what is done during that time period.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Quick question. I just know, so Bradley Lake, 120 megawatts, somewhere in the few hundred million dollar, 250 or 300, whatever.
Was it 380?
380.
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And this would be 459 megawatts at $6 billion or potentially more, since these projects, from what I understand about big mega projects, tend to go over budget and over time historically. So your dollar per megawatt is quite a bit more for this project, right?
Through the chair, I think that Representative Wool, there are some financing scenarios that we've done, and we have some additional detail that we can certainly provide to the committee that shows the financing examples and how we would how we analyze the cost per kilowatt hour or the capacity on that. So I don't know if that's with the time in 1991 when the project was built, I'm not exactly sure we're in an apples-to-apples comparison with respect to the time when Bradley was built versus when we're looking at Susitna-Wautauna. I don't know if we inflationed the Bradley project, and we can probably do those calculations. We can provide that information for you.
Yeah. Follow up, please. I guess the economy of scale, that was, you know, you'd think if you're building something a lot bigger for a lot more money, you would get some economy of scale. But and that's to be determined, I understand, because the inflation on $300 million in 91.
And through the chair, Representative Wool, I think, you know, that's where with the analysis of the project, I think it comes down to, I think everybody wants to know, what is this project going to cost per kilowatt hour? And I think that's where we've done the calculations to look at certain estimates of that. And again, they are estimates. We're using, this presentation is using 2014 dollars. We haven't converted anything into 2015 dollars. And so there's always that march of time that you don't inflation proof anything until you actually get it built and construction. So there is that. But I think what we've tried to do is do the analysis on an estimated cost per kilowatt hour and how those costs could be spread over time.
Thank you.
Representative Klayman?
Just a follow-up. But, I mean, I understand you've got all your statistics, but I don't think you've really answered Representative Wolf's question. What we're talking about is a dam that's 8 to 10 times the expense of Susitna-Wautauna that just in rough numbers is not even getting 4 times the megawatt capacity. I mean, that's pretty, I'm not, you know, the world's best mathematician, but I don't have to get very far to look at 120 megawatts is what Bradley Lake is producing, and 459 is what Susitna-Wautauna, which is less than 4 times of Bradley Lake, and the numbers you're telling me is at least 8 times as much.
Through the chair, Representative Klayman, I think actually the calculation and what has been used before or what we've been using is not, it's not just looking at the capacity of the generators that are there. It's actually looking at the amount of energy that's produced. And so the number to use that I don't think is being recognized is the 2,800 gigawatt hours per year that the project is estimated to produce. And so it's not just about the generators and the capacity of the project. It's actually about the energy generated.
Well, on the same thing, Paul, what's the gigawatt generation from Bradley Lake on an annual basis?
Brian, do you have that figure?
Through the chair, the annual generation of Bradley Lake is approximately 380,000 megawatt hours, so about one-seventh of what the proposed opposed to Sitna Watana would be.
Any other questions? You may proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Where we're at right now with respect to the project status, and I'm on slide 29, we are in a FERC integrated licensing process. We have completed three environmental field seasons, and although not all 58 studies require field work, we have 58 FERC-approved studies through this integrated licensing process. We filed our initial study report in June of 2014, and there are several tech memos that were filed with FERC that support the initial study report. And our engineering feasibility report, which is on our webpage, was released in January 2015 that refined the cost estimates and some additional information with respect to the preliminary design of the project. And because of the Admin Order 271 with respect to the kind of pause of the project and not spending non-discretionary funds, we have asked and FERC has granted a licensing abeyance with respect to the project. And just before the administrative order came out on December 26, we filed our information with OMB as required from that report in the beginning of January. Where we would have been in, with the project status would be to hold a couple series of meetings and follow-up meetings for our initial study report meetings. We would have had some meetings, filed some information there with FERC. The federal resource agencies and other stakeholders would have an opportunity to comment on that on that information. And what we would have been looking at that time prior to the administrative order is a study plan determination from FERC after that initial study report was filed. So,
Representative Colbert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So how much you're talking about the abatement of the project with the administrative order. So how much funding do we have on hand for this project? How much is it encumbered, and what's it encumbered with? What projects?
Through the chair, Representative Culver, from our administrative order submitted, and I believe OMB has had this information on the webpage, of the authorized funds that we were provided of $192 million, $158 million, and this is as of December 31st. Now, some of this has changed since then. We had $19 million encumbered. We have some essential tasks that, although our unencumbered funds, there are essential tasks that we'd need to complete. You know, for example, there's tagged animals. There's radio-collared animals and some field work that we'd have to do to remove some equipment that we currently don't have encumbered, but we'd have to do in compliance with any type of a pause or a stoppage of the project. And so we also have our budgeted personnel costs. So our non-discretionary funds, based upon what we provide in the administrative order, at the time is about $26 to $27 million. Now, what I will note on this, since this is a December 31st date, of those encumbered funds, many of those funds have been expended. They were encumbered with work that has been completed, and we're waiting for the invoices and the bills to come in from contractors.
So how much is unencumbered?
The $6.6 million is available. Pursuant to the administrative order, we provided the detail that listed the $6.681 million.
Okay, and you mentioned personnel costs. So AEA, you have a direct charge off to projects for personnel costs, or how does that work with your operating budget?
Through the chair, Representative Culver, we have project staff that are devoted to the project, and we also have some staff that are with ADA, are part of our shared services calculation to support the project. For example, our accounting staff and procurement staff would be essentially a shared services cost of the project, but we do have a small core of devoted Sitna Watana staff members.
Okay. Okay, so follow-up matters, Mr. Madam Chair. Sure. So how long are we going to keep these devoted contract staff on? At some point, we have to reach a decision on what we're going to do with this project, and are we just going to keep that staff on until the money runs out, or are we going to try to maintain some cash and wind it down? What is? Do you have a exit plan or a operational plan at this point for this project and the staffing?
Well, through the chair, Representative Culver, as we pointed out in our response to the administrative order, the if the $6.6 million was made available for other non-project purposes, our plan would be to have, you know, the it outlines the personnel cost for 2015 and then also some additional work to complete and kind of, I lack of a better word, button up the project by December of 2015. And so we would then, you know, kind of pause the project at that point. However, if the $6.6 million isn't removed from the project, there are some incremental things that we could continue to do with respect to, you know, moving the project forward and best preserving the investment that the state of Alaska has already made with respect to the project. And so those are things that I think are, you know, part of the discussion with the administration, with response to the Administrative Order 271, and then also with the legislative committees. We've provided an overview and a great deal of information to the Senate Finance Committee with respect to, you know, very similar questions that are being asked here.
Thank you.
Okay. Yes, Representative Nagy.
God, we've spent a lot of money over the years on this project, and the population is growing, going to continue to grow. And if we have, and we still need to extract resources from our land, because that's where we are. We're a natural resource state, and if we want to be able to extract those resources, we need to do it at a cost that's energy with energy cost load. And so, and we spent millions of dollars already, and then there's a possibility that millions more will be spent, and this will be using money we can someday repay, well, not repay, but you know, use it to better the lives of people throughout the state, especially people who are, you know, that power line can go a long ways. We can send that power to a lot of those villages that have, you know, $7 or $20 a gallon for fuel costs. I mean, it's going to continue to grow. This is $214, and every year the dollar goes up, and the dollar does less. So, you know, we've spent this, we've studied it, we've, you know, and we're just going to get rid of it? When there's high cost of feel energy right now and continues to grow every year? Thank you.
Representative Clayman.
A couple of follow-ups on Representative Culver's question. How many dedicated staff? It sounds like you've got some in ADA that are kind of cross-designated. They're working on this project but could be working on other projects. How many dedicated staff that are just working on Susitna-Watana?
Through the chair, Representative Clayman, I want to say right now, I think we have a 7 dedicated staff specific to the project. With respect to the shared services, it's a percentage of a variety of different people. I would have to do some type of calculation on that.
So the follow-up, the ADA folks are actually working partly on Susitna-Watana and partly on other projects as well?
Through the chair, for the shared services, I should point out something on the Alaska Energy Authority and ADA. Technically, AEA doesn't have employees. All of the employees in PCNs show up under the ADA component under personal services. So in many respects, a lot of the work that's being done on AEA projects, you know, it's technically all being done by ADA staff. However, we do have a separation of duties with folks reporting through the reporting chain to me versus to John Springsteen, the new executive director of ADA. So there's a little bit of different, but yes, especially with the folks, to provide a very good shared services and economies of scale, especially in our procurement and in our accounting group. There's a group of people that pay bills, so that they pay Susitna bills and they pay, you know, other bills that are in the agencies.
And further follow up, so when you talk with Representative Culber about, or described it kind of a button-up process, if the governor were to say to you April 1st, button it up by the end of summer, by the end of August, would that be a problem for you to button the project up by the end of August?
Through the chair, Representative Klayman, that's what we tried to describe in our response to the administrative orders, that we really think that in order to responsibly button up the project, we would need until December 31st to be able to do that with the work that's in the field. And all of that is detailed out into the administrative order. However, it would be removing field equipment, preparing the permit compliance reports for any of the land use permits that we have. The Department of Fish and Game has surveys for collared moose, caribou, and ptarmigan, and those wouldn't be finished by August 31st. So there's a lot of, with 58 studies and the amount of work that's been done in the field, there's a lot of ongoing activity that would need to be considered as we shut down that work.
And further follow up is, if you were to go continue all the way through the end of December, is that $6.6 million worth of work, or is to finish that up a whole lot less than $6.6? I certainly understand that there's a whole bunch of features we could keep spending money on this and figure out how to spend $6.6 million, but if it's just wind it down most effectively as possible, how much is that going to cost in rough terms?
Through the chair, Representative Klayman, actually the 6.6 is after the December 31st. In compliance with the administrative order, we provided that detail, and then to button up the project, in compliance, in response to the administrative order, the 6.6 is after we do those things and after December 31st.
Let's move on. We're getting short of time. Can you proceed with the next slide?
Yes, Madam Chair. So the environmental study process on slide 30, this just gives you a show of where we're at. We're at the study plan development, the study implementation phase. And continuing on with the licensing process, there would be an impact assessment and then a process to develop the protection, mitigation, and enhancement measures for the project. So on slide 31, this past year, we had more than 200 people in the field. And we've actually had 200 people in the field in the prior year. This past year, with the limited funds that we had, there was roughly about the same number of people, but they were in for shorter durations of time to do some work. We have completed data collection for 13 of the FERC-approved studies. All of those have been listed here to be completed. So under the economic impact, I apologize for this first bullet. We have not employed 65% of Alaskans, but of the people employed in the project, 65% of them are Alaskan residents. So we apologize for that little bit of a grammatical issue there. We definitely have capitalized on the Pacific Northwest hydroelectric experience while maintaining the Alaska hire. So there is a lot of expertise in the Pacific Northwest with respect to projects. $7 million earned in Alaska wages in 2014. And in 2013, we didn't do a similar analysis for 2014. However, in 2013, which is a very significant field season, $6 million was spent directly in goods and services in the Matsu Valley area.
Ms. Fischer-Go, Representative Culver.
Yeah, just real briefly, just for a follow-up on that, provide us with a spreadsheet on what firms were hired, the contract amount, their discipline, and where they're located, and then their what their local hire component was, dollar amount, number, so we have an idea. Thank you. That's a follow-up to provide the committee with. Thank you.
Through the chair, Mr. Co-Chair, we certainly will do that. So One of the things, you know, with respect to the project, you know, this is it is a remote location, and there's a significant amount of work that needs to be done in order to file a comprehensive license application. And the work that we've been doing has been really to understand the Susitna Basin. So there's, you know, a lot of the work in the studies is really to understand what impact this project may bring. And, you know, of course, all of that would be to go to this protection, mitigation, and enhancement measures as we get ready to file for a license application. So this is just kind of an idea of some of the work that we've done. You know, when you look at the expenditures that we've had and the investment that the state of Alaska has made, it has been to really advance the science and understand this area significantly. I'm not going to read all of these bullets, but you know, we've been in close coordination with the Department of Fish and Game for most of the work. We've used University of Alaska Fairbanks. We've used the Department of Natural Resources on the OPUMP projects in coordination with the Department of or the Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys. So we've capitalized as extensively as possible with our own state and local expertise. One thing with respect to the Department of Fish and Game, the biologists and the expertise that comes out of Fish and Game is it's world class, very very excellent scientists that are housed in this State Department. So the wildlife studies in.
If you can proceed to wrap up, can you save your questions? We're running out of time, Mr. Representative.
I can wait. I had a question related to those slides, but I can certainly.
Yeah, I did too. Just another question, but a comment. Real quick.
Well, it is 10 to 12, and
this is a closeout item. If you just allow me now. Thank you.
I'm not sure we can get through all the slides, which is why I wanted to ask.
That's okay. You may, Representative Klayman, you may ask quickly your question.
Sure. I read a newspaper article shortly after Administrative Order 271 came out that I think someone from the connected with the Susitna Dam saying that they believe the dam would actually enhance salmon habitat and the salmon would do better post-dam than in the current natural ecosystem. What is the official position of the AEA with regard to whether the dam will improve salmon habitat or not?
Through the chair, Wayne Dyack, I believe, has dialed back in, and I think he could answer those questions. And I, with respect to that, I think I'll just say real briefly, though, that with respect to the design of the project, there is the turbidity and some of the sediment would not flow. It sounds like Wayne is on the phone. Wayne, do you want to save me on this one?
Yes, two services. For the record, this is Wayne Dyack. I'm the project manager for the Alaska Energy Authority. So the way we look at this is there are some positives that will come out of the the project in terms of the ability to manage for the salmon.
Excuse me. Can you
hear me?
Yes, a lot clearer.
Okay, so the there's a couple of aspects here. Okay, I'm so sorry. Yeah, this is Wayne Dyack. I'm the project manager for the Susitna Watana project. So what I was saying is there are several attributes that may help the salmon fishery. The first aspect is we will reduce the turbidity, and that could have a beneficial impact. The second aspect is we will have the ability to manage water temperatures and provide water temperatures that are more appropriate for the fishery. And the third is understanding the flows. We may be able to manage the flows to better meet the needs of the salmon. So those are the things that we're in the process of assessing. We still need to undertake more of the evaluations. We have a very sophisticated modeling approach that we're doing to evaluate those impacts. And we're not at the point yet where we can make definitive statements. So I think the official position of the Alaska Authority is that there could be be some positive, you know, benefits, but we won't know that until we actually complete the analyses.
Representative Clayman, if you have additional questions, come see us, the two co-chairs, and we can prepare a letter. You can submit your questions collectively to the administration for answer. Representative Culver,
quickly. Yeah, on slide 33, it says contributed 4,500 tissue samples to ADFNG genetic lab. Is that pre-funded to get the analysis done on those? Because if you're going to close out, I'm concerned about, there's a big backlog at that lab, concerned about getting the genetic analysis done and so we can catalog that data.
You can submit that response in writing. Let's continue with the presentation.
And yeah, Representative Culver will provide that information to you. So the wildlife studies, we have done a significant amount of work on looking at the moose, caribou, and Dall's sheep with the surveys. And again, these are a lot of there's radioed, collared animals that are out there that we'd certainly have to make sure that we close up that study working with Fish and Game. So the cultural resources, in addition to the water, fish, and wildlife resources that we have to look at, there's also the cultural resources of the area. Looking at the human use of the region and looking at all of the different areas. Now, the Otna has been the primary traditional users of the area with respect to the project. There would be also studies done with respect to the Denaina people. We have not completed those studies yet, but there's both the Otna and the Denaina cultural resource studies that would be completed in the area. So I know we're running out of time, Madam Chair, and so I don't know how further we want, but this was the point that I was going to turn the presentation over to talk a bit more specifically on the potential impacts to Betsy McGregor, our environmental manager, on this project. I just want to point out, this is on slide 36, the areas of the river where we have the upper river that would be above the dam, the middle river, and the lower river. And this is a very significant drainage that it's not just the Susitna River in the area. There are other rivers and tributaries contributing to this. And so we have a series of slides to discuss this work. Most of the work has been concentrated in under the upper end of the middle river section. So Betsy, if you want to take over on slide 37, Madam Chair, if you want to, I don't know if you want to continue on with this at this point. I guess it looks like we're at noon. If you'd like us to jump ahead.
Wrap it up, go quickly through each slide.
Okay.
And if committee members have questions, they will submit them in writing and we'll submit a letter.
Okay, Madam Chair. Betsy, on slide 37.
Yes, for the record, this is Betsy McGregor, the Susitna Wamsutta Environmental Manager. In the interest of time, I'm not going to go into detail on the bullets on slide 37. We've implemented fish distribution and relative abundance studies, collected water quality, sediments, bedload, hydrology, and ice processes data, and developed and calibrated models for baseline conditions. Based on those results, these are some of the similarities that we found with the 1980s, and it has helped us to find the areas of potential impact. Slide 38 indicates the average annual flow contribution. It provides context for the relative portion of the total Susitna River flow impacted by the dam and significant influences attenuating potential project effects related to flow, sediment, water quality, and ice processes. The Susitna River above the dam contributes 16% of the total Susitna River flow. In the middle river, the tributaries contribute another 4%. The Tulitna River contributes approximately 18% and the Talkeetna 8%. These two rivers significantly influence the river downstream from the confluence. At this point, the Susitna River contributes approximately a third of the flow, and the width of the river, the main stem Susitna River, quadruples below this confluence. The Yenta River contributes 40% of the total Susitna River flow, heavily influencing the Susitna River below its confluence, which is why potential impacts of the dam's riverine resources below the Yentna River will be insignificant. Slide 39 indicates the average annual bed load contributions. It shows both the water and sediment balance for the middle and lower Susitna River. It's similar to the information from the 1980s in terms of overall contributions of water and sediment in their basin. The Tulitna is the dominant source of gravel, contributing 26% of the sediment, 13% of which is composed of gravel. The Talkeetna contributes a large portion of gravel as well. Both of these rivers contribute more than the Susitna River. In contrast, the Susitna River above the dam contributes approximately 11% of the sediment load, and it is nearly all sand and silt. The bed material load contribution of the tributaries in the middle river is generally dominated by gravels, and the Yentna River is the largest contributor of both water and bed load material, with the bed load dominated by sand. And this goes to some of the comments that have been made by Wayne in the past regarding the impact to salmon. The quality of salmon spawning substrate will not be negatively impacted in the Susitna River main stem by the dam, because the upper Susitna River is not a source for this important spawning substrate. Water in the middle river will be clearer due to the dam capturing the silt load. The extent to which this will occur and its potential impact to fish is among the elements being studied. Moving on to slide number 40, this indicates the spawning distribution of salmon in the Susitna River watershed. To understand the impacts of the dam on fish, we need to understand what species of fish and life stages use the river, in what locations and habitats, and when. As you can see, 95% of the total Susitna River escapement for Chinook, Coho, and Chum salmon occur in the lower river, below the Three Rivers confluence, and primarily within the tributaries of the lower river. Approximately 5% of the total escapement of these three species spawn in the middle river, again, primarily in tributaries. And then for sockeye salmon, as you can see, it's less than 1% of the total escapement even enter the middle river. It's important to note the distribution of the salmon because the potential project impacts to riverine processes and the quality and quantity of salmon habitat will be significantly attenuated in the lower river due to the influence of the significant tributaries in that reach. And the majority of the spawning occurs in the tributaries, which will not be impacted by the project at all. And a portion of the rearing life cycle of the juvenile fish also occurs within these tributaries that will not be impacted. Moving on to slide 41, this just provides more detailed breakdown of the distribution of Chinook salmon spawning in the Susitna River. Again, approximately 95% of the total escapements in the lower basin, fairly evenly distributed among the significant tributaries, with less than 3% spawning in the main river. Approximately 5% spawn in the main river, with less than 0.5% spawning in the main stem. Important middle river tribs are Portage Creek, Indian River, and Gold Creek. Less than 5% of the total escapement pass above Devil's Canyon. It's an impediment to all anadromous fish except Chinook salmon, which have been found to pass in small numbers. And of this, some of them use tributaries between Devil's Canyon and the dam site. Another, even less than 0.5%, and that's a conservative estimate, pass above the dam site for spawning. And they primarily spawn in a couple of tribs, primarily Christina Creek. In 2014, we employed sonar at the dam site, and 24 fish greater than 50 centimeters in length, which were assumed to be Chinook salmon adults, passed above the dam site. Moving on to slide 42, this is a more detailed distribution of coho salmon spawning in the Susitna River. Again, approximately 95% of the escapement, the total escapement, is to the lower river basin, with less than 6% spawning in the main stem lower river. Approximately 5% spawn or escape to the middle river watershed, with less than 0.5% spawning in the main stem middle Susitna River. No coho salmon have ever been documented above Devil's Canyon. Moving on to slide 43, this is just a recap of the radio telemetry studies that have been conducted regarding Chinook salmon. We tagged fish, ADF, and this was a cooperative study with Fish and Game. Fish and Game tagged fish in the lower river. AEA's contractors tagged fish at Curry, which is approximately 20 miles above the Three Rivers confluence. The first set of numbers indicate the number of adult Chinook salmon that were tagged at Curry. The next set of numbers indicate the number that went to Devil's Canyon, but did not go up and through the canyon. The canyon itself has three impediments, with the third impediment being the most difficult for fish to pass. The next set of numbers, the 10, 3, and 2, represent the number of tag Chinook salmon from Curry that were able to pass impediment 3 in Devil's Canyon. And the passage of these fish only occurred at extremely low flows near the 10% exceedance. Of these fish, the last set of fish indicate the number that spawned in tributaries above the dam site, primarily within Cosina Creek. And with that, I'll pass it on to, back to Sarah.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Culver.
On the caribou studies, Betsy, right?
Yes.
I talked with some biologists that worked on the 80s study, and they said that one of the issues that they thought was a problematic was that the large reservoir was going to, as you know, the Neltina herd goes from Denali through this area. It's a summer kind of fall range. Do we do any research or analysis on the ability of the herd to cross the reservoir and migrate through the area?
Through the chair, we are funding Fish and Game. We've been funding them since 2012, building upon a study that they already had underway, looking at the Neltina and Delta caribou herds. They're looking at their migration and their productivity, calf survival. We augmented their studies by adding GPS collars so they could get fine resolution of movement. And these are among the collared animals that Sarah Fisher Goad referenced as one of the things that we identified to continue studying, since these animals have already been collared and the state has invested money in that already. Fish and Game has provided some interesting results thus far, and those are provided in our initial study report and some of the tech memos that have been produced since then.
Okay, thank you. If you could give me that initial study report, I'd much appreciate it.
Yes.
Is there anything else?
Madam Chair, we talked a little bit about some of the engineering accomplishments, and I just point out at the bottom, here's just an example. I think because Hoover Dam is roughly the same height that we're looking at in this project, I think the goal here is just to kind of look that, you know, that there's different numbers on capacities for projects and that estimated annual generation. And so really, to in order to get your cost per kilowatt hour, you really do look at that annual generation amount, not necessarily the capacity. Our feasibility report has been completed. This is the project cost range that you can see with the standard S curve on. You know, the base cost estimate is a $5.6 to $5.7 billion. That's right in the middle there. With the, you know, you can see the maximum cost and then also the minimum cost of the project. And because we are done with the preliminary engineering report, we would not be updating this cost estimate again until we would be in a, if we are able to get to licensing and then a potential construction, we would be looking at the more geotechnical work to provide some information to kind of further refine the cost estimate of the project. We have looked at different financing options. We actually have some detailed information that we've provided to Senate Finance. We can certainly provide to this committee with the different types of financing models. Looking at RUS financing, the RUS has said that this project is eligible to approximately 50% of the project. We've looked at some blended rates on financing options. You know, ironically, with the different types of refinements that we've done with our FA, looking at even just our basic economic model from a couple years ago of roughly 7 cents a kilowatt hour, based upon a way that you wouldn't finance it, but it would be a way to just start looking at these costs per kilowatt hours, that we're seeing some general comparisons. I mentioned the Bradley Lake model before. This would be where there would be a state investment up front and then paying it off at the tail end of the project, where you can see that that's a significant cost per kilowatt hour reduction, again based on 2014 dollars. And again, we've looked at different types of financing. We're not assuming the Bradley model. We're not assuming a significant state investment of construction dollars to fund the construction of the project. This is really...
Excuse me, I have a quick question. You used the acronym RUS for the record. What does that stand for?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry about that. Rural Utility Services is a U.S. Department of Agriculture funding source. So this is slide 47. This is just a comparison that we've used to really show with a potential cost of power, how it would compare to natural gas and the real cost of power over the years. So one of the things that we've used this slide in a couple different formats, and one of the things to look at where we kind of, you know, you go back to that why hydro is important, that although hydro is more expensive than natural gas generation at the front end, because you inflation-proof that, your real costs actually decrease over time, whereas your natural gas costs are anticipated to increase over time. That's not necessarily an inflation-proof generation source. So this is just an example of what we've tried to use, you know, on that for potential costs of power. So that completes our presentation. I'd be happy to meet with the legislators individually and to answer any additional questions.
Well, thank you for this thorough and wonderful presentation. We will be developing a list of questions. I'll be working with my colleagues on the committee, and we'll be sending something over to you. And thank you very much. For the record, when I was chair of Shugach Electric, we came down. We asked for the first appropriation to get this project going. Nothing had been done since the 80s. We came down in 2007. And we did obtain that first appropriation to get to essentially study the possibility of the dam and scale it back, you know, to the size we're looking at now. So with that said, thank you again. And the Energy Committee is now adjourned until Tuesday, March 31st, 12:14.